welcome to the Film Stage Podcast. I'm Bruno Rao.
And I'm Dan Mecca.
And for this special episode, we are going to discuss Inception.
All Inception, yeah.
Now, this is a film that we've been anticipating for a long time.
About a year, I guess.
I remember last spring it was announced that Christopher Nolan, the director of Dark Knight, Batman Begins, Memento, Prestige, yeah, that he will be doing a film based on the architecture of the mind.
Yep.
And we were both really excited for it. I think we talked about it in one of our first podcasts.
About there was a book called The Architecture of the Mind, and people were, you know, suggesting, you know, hypothesizing was and some sort of loose adaptation of it, which, you know, I don't even know if that came to fruition, probably not, but
and then it got announced, you know, the stellar cast, Leo DiCaprio.
A couple months later, yeah, Leo, and then everyone else kind of followed suit.
Ellen Page, yeah. And now, I mean, we saw it last night.
Yeah, and now it's come and gone, essentially.
Yeah, and now, I mean, Warner Brothers, this is their big movie of the year.
$185 million.
And they said they put over $100 million into marketing so far.
Yeah, I'm sure. I was going to say, I'm sure there must have been, altogether, must have been over a $300 million endeavor.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, you know, is to be expected. But, I mean, also not to be expected. I mean, this is a movie, you know, in other podcast or radio casts, you know, shows like The Business, for example, they mentioned at one point that, you know, if Inception doesn't succeed, Hollywood's going to just really be confused because you have movies like Prince of Persia not really doing well, movies like, you know, Sorcerer's Apprentice aren't, you know, these Bruckheimer movies, Sorcerer's Apprentice isn't tracking well. You know, Bruckheimer, you know, is always usually the go-to guy, even if the product's not great, he's always seems to be able to sell his movies. These movies aren't selling anymore. Anyway, there's a couple other examples.
Like A-Team, Nine Day,
you know, just a lot of movies that should have been sure things weren't. So Inception is this really risky kind of art heist film that we've been hearing so much about. And so, I mean, I think a lot of what happens next summer or the summer after that kind of hinges on the success of this movie. So,
yeah. So I mean, we'll talk spoiler free for a while, and then we'll jump into it. So don't be afraid. Keep listening.
Let
me do it. So do you want to jump in?
Yeah, jump into it. Okay, so I'll go to you, Jordan. Let's talk about for you. What were you expecting going into the movie? What were you expecting out of it? And then what did you take from it?
So just a little, you know, background. I watched every trailer multiple times, every TV spot multiple times. I watched the clips. There's four clips. Watched them once each. Listened to pretty much every interview that was there, and I was still surprised, and this exceeded my hype. The good thing, I mean, Cillian Murphy in a BBC interview, he was saying how even if you've seen every little piece of marketing, you still don't really know what the movie's about, and which is so true. I mean, there's so many things, even pieces of the trailer are in totally different context in the film than what you think.
Totally.
This wildly exceeded all my hype. Very, very few nitpicks throughout it, but other than that, it's just one of the most entertaining, absorbing films that I've seen in a long, long time.
Yeah, no, I mean, definitely one of the, I mean, as a summer blockbuster, one of the most entertaining, smart, funny, entertaining films since The Dark Knight. You know what I mean? Really, I mean, you know, since, you know, and probably, I mean, you know, it's a little early to say, but probably more so than The Dark Knight. I would say just in terms of creativity and imagination, it does trump a superhero movie, you know, because this is something that's, you know, just more original
The Dark Knight, you have the basic setup of, you know, the superhero and you kind of know, even if you don't know what's going to happen, you kind of can see where things are going.
Right. And Nolan did do a great job of convincing you maybe that this was a world where the rules could change, but they didn't. You know, his achievement was convincing you that they could, and that's
This is the movie where he just makes his own rules for something.
Exactly, yeah. So, I mean, I think, as for me, you know, I was similar. My hype and my personal expectations were on the same level as yours. I took another route. I tried to be a little bit less absorbed with everything else. Like, I didn't even know there were four clips, actually. I read, like, the American Cinematographer article about how they shot a lot of the stuff. That got me really excited. You know, I watched the trailer 1,000 times and everything like that, and, you know, listened to the soundtrack, what bits of the soundtrack we got before the movie. But in general, you know, I only really saw a couple little, you know, 3-minute interviews with Leo and whatnot. And you know, like you said, I went in really not knowing exactly, you know, I knew there would be a heist involved, but I really didn't know, exactly what it would be about. I really was enthralled. You know, I was captivated. All those hyperbolic words that you know a lot of critics use, maybe when they're not needed or particularly deserved. I feel like this movie is the exception. I mean, my mouth is open for, you know, for half of it, just about what was going on. And it just, you know, I mean, like, look, this isn't, you know, I was talking to a couple people last night. This isn't, you know, in terms of themes and tones and observation, this isn't on the same level of a 2001 or even something like The Fountain, where it's exploring these very vast and general, you know, tapestry of emotions and what have you, and, like, you know, ideas about the world in this really macro way. It's more of a character thing, you know what I mean? Yeah. It's much more of a personal, you know, heist film, kind of, with, like, you know, last job thing going on here, and it doesn't really try to reach at any big themes, but the movie itself kind of just creates a world that is itself within a mind, and it kind of just shows how complicated just one mind can be, you know, and I think that in staying small, even though it's big, mm-hmm. it kind of maintains the entertainment value, you know what I mean? It doesn't try to do too much, really, which sounds funny to say, but, like, I really appreciated that, because then you have all these amazing things kind of happening in small ways, you know? Like, when you watch the trailer, it's funny, like, when watching that trailer, I was expecting something like, I don't know, something just epic, and it is an epic film, but all of those scenes in the trailer where you're like, oh my gosh, I can't wait to see that, they come and go kind of quickly. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, it's not really a movie like The Dark Knight was very much, here's a huge set piece, here's a huge
exactly.
set piece.
Exactly. It's
feels
not really like
an hour. Oh, this isn't really a spoiler. I mean, an hour of just, like, everything is, like, the editing in this movie. I mean, Lee Smith should just give an Oscar. Like,
Like,
you just are pulled back and forth in these different areas, and
yeah,
everything kind of meshes together.
That's a perfect way, because, like, in The Dark Knight, in that trailer, you see the truck flipping over, and you see, you know, the just all those scenes, you know, with the motorcycle flying out of the thing, the hospital exploding. And in the movie, it is what you would expect from the trailer. There are these, you know, 15, 20-minute sequences that build up to these incredible things, and it is as epic as you would expect it. But in Inception, I mean, and this is not to its detriment, but just in a completely different way, those scenes are just part of this world where that stuff happens all the time. So by the end of it, like, you've just been bombarded, but in a kind of a subtle way with all this
stuff.
Yeah,
well, like, with The Dark Knight,
if
you love that truck flipping scene, like, you see it in the movie, and then you're done with it. In this movie, like, if you loved a certain part, the movie comes back to that, over and over again,
true,
and it kind of, like, you're just, like, every time you see it, if you love, I mean, every,
very
I would say every
self-contained
element. Yeah.
And, you know, like, so, and that's what I mean, it's not like, you know, that's, it's not quite, I mean, it is, this is entertainment, you know, at its purest form, truthfully, and
yeah.
I mean, that is a compliment every way. I mean, this is the perfect blockbuster, you know, and so, you know, for the Kubrick comparisons, I don't really fully understand that, because Kubrick didn't make blockbusters, but I mean, it's a good thing that this isn't like Kubrick, because, you know, Nolan's not like Kubrick, he's not like Spielberg, he's not like Scorsese, he's not like Cameron. I mean, he is good enough now to be his own name,
yeah.
so that we can say 5 years from now, this is like a Nolan film, you know, and so
some,
I think that's a good thing.
Someone brought up that, like, Kubrick did do The Killing, which is the only film in his library that I would kind of slightly
compare to. Yeah,
but if you, I mean, people have been comparing this to 2001, like, that's like the big comparison, and I
and
don't
there,
think...
There are
shots, yeah.
And there are nice things. Yeah, no, I agree.
Yeah.
I don't think that it's like 2001 at all, but I mean, what is nice about this movie, and about all of Nolan's movies, is he's a filmmaker who loves films, you know, as many are, but I mean, he loves, you know, films obviously, clearly a lot, because you have a Citizen Kane reference, you have, you know, a very, you know, kind of, you know, a nice little 2001 reference towards the end, and, you know, little things throughout.
I mean,
that,
The Matrix,
you know,
is a huge
part,
which I kind of want to talk about the comparison to The Matrix.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably the movie it most closely takes from,
yeah.
you know.
Then, I mean, with The Matrix, though, I was thinking about this last, you know, since I've seen it. When you're watching The Matrix, you always kind of feel like you're watching a movie, because even the cinematography is kind of very stylized, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like, with this film, what Wally Pfister did, like, kind of made everything kind of believable. Like, not, I mean, this is a wild idea, but, like just the way he shot it didn't have those, like, very high contrast colors, you know what I mean? Like,
true. I mean, I agree. It's more classically shot, as opposed to, like, you know, the colors in The Matrix are...
Yeah.
I mean, not even the colors, like, the costume design.
The costume, yeah,
everybody's
no, everything, the production design,
and stuff, like... And
you always kind of feel like you're watching a movie, but then, you know... But with this movie, I just kind of always felt like, oh, okay, like, this looks pretty realistic. Like, yeah.
But also, and see, this is the other thing, though, about, and this is the biggest difference if we're talking about Matrix Inception comparisons. The biggest difference I took from that comparison, when, you know, is that in the Matrix, in the beginning of the movie, it establishes all the rules, right? Because, you know, you have Neo, who Morpheus, is a regular person, and then Morpheus is like, hey, listen, like, you've been living, this is all fake. This is the real world. This is the fake world. So we live in the real world, then we go into the fake world to, like, take on these people, blah, 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 blah. This is the world we live in, all this stuff, the agents. So in the first 30 minutes, all the rules are established, and then they play the game, which is essentially, it's an action movie. It's a chase scene. It's a, you know, it's a heist, whatever. So it becomes a standard movie in a world of non-standard rules. But the thing about this movie that makes it, maybe a little bit more exciting, you know, in a lot of ways, is that it establishes the rules. You know, you have this Ellen Page character who's hired, you know, and you can get as much from the trailer, and she's kind of the person, she's the audience, you know, so Leo is explaining these worlds, this world to her. And so in the first hour, everything's explained, but because it's a world that is controlled by dreams and controlled by the subconscious,
those wild cards,
the rules are constantly broken, yeah, and things are constantly reformed. So literally, you kind of have to ride with the changes, as opposed to the Matrix, which gives you something and then says, hey, you know, believe this and go along with us. Like, Neo is the one. Believe this and then go along with it. You know what I mean? It's not like that. I mean, you know, Inception says, believe this if you want, but if we go into someone else's dream, it'll change because they believe something else.
Yeah.
And so that's obviously a fascinating, you know, a fascinating use of obviously the dreamscape. And I mean, I think I know a few movies that take it to the levels, you know, no pun intended, obviously, with you know, the movie, but that this movie takes it to. So I think, yeah, I mean, I really was impressed. I mean, now, okay, let's get down to performances and stuff and writing and stuff. So, like, what do you want to talk about?
Like, complexity, because that's a huge issue with this.
Right.
Well, I think, yeah. I mean, if this is a movie where, from the beginning, you're going to want to kind of give your attention to, and,
yeah,
and it, you know, it requires it. Yeah. And, I mean, people are saying that, oh, it's so confusing, you'll have to go in and see it a second time. Like, if you pay attention...
Well, hopefully you go and see it.
Oh, yeah.
But you won't. But, yeah, but you won't need to, though.
Yeah, if you pay attention, you... I mean, there are... I mean, we'll talk about spoilers. There are some confusing things that... Especially in the third act. But it's all stuff that, you know, that is really interesting and discussion-worthy. But it's not like... It's not like you'll leave dissatisfied, I don't think. But if you... But yeah, no. If you kind of pay attention, I don't think this is an extremely complex film. Like, obviously, for summer blockbuster, it is, but not...
But, like, I mean, if you... It's structured in a way that you can stay with it. I mean, I stayed with it. I got the overlying narrative, you know, and I totally understood what they were doing, and if you just kind of pay attention, I think that you'll be fine. I mean, I really, you know, so I think the worry that this movie is too complex for people is really, it's patronizing, it's condescending, you know, and I think that when people see it, they'll realize that it is, you know, that's true, because, you know, I got it, and if I can get it, anyone can get it, you know what I mean? So I think you're totally spot on, you know, I definitely agree.
Yeah, but no, performances, I mean, we can, I mean, I think there's not a weak note.
No, yeah, I mean, and also the thing is true, I mean, this is true for the movie, I don't know that any of the performances are particularly difficult.
Right.
Like, I don't see Leo DiCaprio getting a nomination for this.
Yeah, you know, I don't think
I don't see that you know, I'm sure there'll be five best actor performances that are better.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't, you know, think that maybe... This is an actor's movie in terms of the Academy, you know, but what does that mean anymore? But I mean, you know, no, I don't think so. But, you know, you were talking about this earlier. This is Leo's first summer movie. And I think, like, wow, you know, he is definitely, he's always been kind of the artsy movie star. He gets $20 million to do movies like The Aviator, so it's a strange life he lives because he kind of makes these movies that never really take much of a profit. You know, they barely make their budget back, but then they win a lot of awards. So it's kind of the kind of movies that studios make so that they can maintain their street cred. You know, those are the movies that Leo makes, you know, and I mean, what a blessed life that is. In this movie, I think he has the opportunity to show that he's a movie star. You know, I mean, he's essentially, you know, a James Bond. He's a, you know, a Thomas Crown, you know, kind of a character in this movie while maintaining these artistic roots that he's come from. And, you know, and so I think he does an amazing job.
Yeah.
You know, and I think he just confirms that he is really one of the most demanding, commanding, you know, leading presences in Hollywood today. And you know, and we were talking to someone earlier, and I mentioned how I don't know that he takes roles that are risky the way that a Daniel Day-Lewis does, you know, like a My Left Foot or like a Gangs of New York. I mean, he was in Gangs of New York and he played the lead and he was bad. You know, yeah. I really didn't like him in that film. And like, you know, I had Daniel Day-Lewis,
There Will Be Blood.
You know, horrible. Yeah, There Will Be Blood, as you know. And he always takes on these really ambitious roles, and that's why he has so much, you know, people appreciate him so much. But meanwhile, Leonardo DiCaprio, he takes these roles, you know, Howard Hughes, you know, What's Eating Gilbert Grape, and even Titanic, like he takes these roles, some of them mainstream, some of them a little off kilter, but they all kind of seem to come from the same place. But he never hits a false note with them, and I think that that's really important. You know what I mean? I think that no one does that better. No one plays that leading man better. I mean, for all the Brad Pitts and Tom Cruises who do great jobs themselves, I don't think anyone right now really compares to Leo in the leading actor's chair. You know. And then as for supporting, I mean, yep. I think, you know, Marion Cotillard is just, like, I don't think I've ever seen anyone look more beautiful in a movie. Like, and clearly this is, you know, this is a compliment, you know, I mean, to her being born, obviously, but, like, but also to the people who did the costume designs and people who did the makeup, like, Jesus.
If I could wear a suit like Joseph Gordon-Levitt or Leo,
everybody in the film looks amazing, but, like, the dress they picked out for her, oh, my gosh, she can kill you with her eyes, let alone the 1,000 other things that she has in the film, but, like, I mean, just, you know, Public Enemies, you know, all these other films she's been in, Go Away, in terms of beauty, like, she has never looked better. And and I mean, if you like nothing in the film, you will love the way she looks. I mean, and that is a compliment to, you know, like I said, makeup and costume and everybody involved, because, oh man, gorgeous. And then like Gordon Levitt, his suits are amazing. Yeah.
And I mean, his performance, he plays, if you've seen it, like the point man.
Yeah.
And he is great. He's kind of like the sidekick character a little bit.
Yeah, I mean,
but I think Ellen Page kind of is a sidekick as well. You know what I mean?
More like, of a sidekick. I think. I mean, I think she's more of like a consigliere. Like she becomes like a more of a confidant. Yeah. You know, as the movie goes on.
Yeah, and anyways, we can talk about the spoilers. But
I think one of the scene stealers for me was Tom Hardy.
Yeah, I was just gonna say
as Eames, who's the. Who's like, they call him the Forger, and he's pretty much like a master of disguise in the film. And he just, you know, he's got that effortless charm, and he's just like, you know, he's got it on full, all cylinders are working, and it's funny, you know, him and Arthur have a nice little banter, because Arthur, who's Joseph Gordon-Levitt, he's a very, you know, kind of a tight ass, the point man, taking everything really seriously. And Eames is kind of like, he's like a gambler, you know, like
literally.
You know, yeah, exactly. So, you know, they have this, you know, yin and yang going on throughout the film. And I think that really works to lighten the load a little bit. Ken Watanabe, oddly, has a lot of funny moments as the
one
guy
thing,
with the money.
This is probably a stupid American thing to say, but there were a few lines where I was like, wait, what did he say? You know, like,
cause Ken Watanabe.
Yeah, there's a few.
Yeah, but and in pretty much every Wanzombie performance, there's
like
a couple
that.
Lines.
Yeah.
Like, whether it be The Last Samurai or even The Dark Knight as Ra's al Ghul.
Yeah.
Or Batman Begins as Ra's al Ghul, rather. Like, I didn't understand half of that performance. But he's good. He's really solid.
Even, now I'm going to forget his name, the chemist from, that plays a chemist in every film.
In the two biggest films of the last 2 years.
Dilip Rao.
He
plays Yusuf in this movie.
He played the scientist from Avatar.
Yeah. And he was fine in Avatar. He really didn't do much, but in this
movie,
he's kind of awesome in this movie. I really loved what he had to do. We can talk about the spoilers.
I liked it. Now that I'm looking at IMDb, I wish Lucas Haas was in the film more.
Yeah.
You know, spoilers, but he's not in it for long, and he is one of these actors who just kind of never made that transition from kid to adult the best that he could have, you know? And
it's
so,
very smooth.
Yeah, and I wish, because he is a talented actor, I wish, I don't know, that he had more to do in anything, and especially this film. But but his role is nice. He has a nice pivotal part and a really awesome opening sequence.
Yes, very, very great opening sequence. I mean, Cillian Murphy, he rocked it, I think.
Yeah, Cillian Murphy did a really good job. But, like, once again, like, these performances, I feel like, if you're going to put people like Tom Berenger and Ken Watanabe and, you know, Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Ellen Page and Marion Cotillard into a film to do what are kind of one note characters in a lot of ways, they're gonna destroy, because I mean, you know, because they're amazing actors, you know, actors and actresses. And, you know, Michael Caine, he has one really nice little scene, you know, and so he comes in, does his thing, and then he's out of there. So, I mean, I think that all overall the acting really is amazing. But, like, I think really the winners here are Nolan and Wally Pfister.
Oh, completely. Yeah, this. I mean, you know, yeah, I think. If you've seen the trailer, you kind of know what to expect, and there's specific shots that are just mind blowing.
And then, the other thing about this movie though that I really love in terms of talking about summer films and just big Hollywood films, and this is definitely qualifies, is though there be countless special effects in this movie and so much special effects. This movie was clearly, so beautifully shot organically. And, for example, a movie like A-Team, which we both enjoyed, one of the pet pieces of that movie is the way that it was shot. You know, you have the handheld. It just seems sloppy. The action scenes were just kind of, all over the place. And the CGI got shitty at the end. And you have a lot of things that just didn't seem to really come together. This movie just seems so planned out. So imagined. And just, you have Wally Pfister just... beautiful. The suits are beautiful. Like we're talking about just every, the costume designers knew exactly what they needed to do. The lighting people knew exactly what they needed to do. They're shooting 360, so, you have these mirror shots, and it's, mind-blowing that the camera's not in the shot. How did they not do that? And, you have Pfister and Nolan. There's no second unit. They're, totally just devoted to every single shot. And it comes through. Anyone who says that it's not important, it's clearly wrong, because for all the special effects, there are so many naturally bred effects in this film that it at once reminds you the beauty of film and what you can do with literally just a film and the ability to splice it up while also showing you and also this is what the future holds in terms of green screen effects, in terms of computer generated effects. I just think that is amazing.
There was never a moment like the last act of A-Team when you can
just tell that's what I mean. Yeah, there's never a moment where you're just I wish that they had gotten another, month to fix this scene or whatever. But, in a lot of ways The Dark Knight was like that because of, when he actually blew up that hospital. Oh, he actually flipped that truck, And this movie's a lot like that. I'd imagine there's a lot more computer generated effects in this,
even scenes where in this thing they said they actually did it, you're still kind of wondering how they did it.
We can talk about
that
later.
It's like wild. Yeah, they, it really is. And but the one thing that this movie is almost, it's kind of selling it as an action blockbuster, but even though there's a couple long stretches where there's not crazy action spectacles, everything feels like there's action in it because of these little even when
the camera's usually always moving, always moving. So that I think that helps a lot because you always feel like things are never gonna stay.
Yeah.
Which is important. So you have a couple of shots the rooftop dialogue scene in Dark Knight when it's going around. And stuff like that just really works in a movie like this where literally the whole idea is that the dream is always unstable.
Yeah.
So, even if they're not in a dream, the idea that things are just never steady is important. And I think that kind of goes to what you're talking about. Everything feels like action.
Yeah.
So.
One reviewer said, it's one long action scene at the end. At the last hour of the movie. It's really not, but, you just get that feeling from the way it's paced and the way it's...
Yeah.
It's crazy. It's just... everything's just pulled off so effortlessly, it feels like.
And what's funny about the movie is it feels short. Because really, it's essentially, a setup and then a mission.
Yeah.
And then that's actually the movie.
Yeah.
And within that mission, because of the way they construct time within the dreams, it goes on for an hour and there's a lot of exposition actually within the ongoings of the mission. But it is just funny because, the mission starts and you're like, wow, okay, here we go. And then when the mission is finished, the movie's done. And you're like, oh, wow, all right, well, now time to go home. So it flies by. Two and a half hours fly by, which is always a good sign. I just really can't wait to go back and knowing the ending and just kind of try to put into pieces, the few questions that it did have at the end.
Absolutely, we can wrap up the spoiler-free section.
Yeah. Well, quickly before we wrap up the spoiler-free, what about the screenplay? there's a couple lines like the rules that were established and stuff.
Yeah,
like
there's a, I mean for I mean nitpicks if you want to get to it. Yeah, there's a few lines that definitely feel very forced and exposition heavy. That, but then looking back though at the end of the movie, you're like, oh okay, that was necessary. But maybe, I mean, they could have done it a different way. Obviously, it's, I mean,
yeah. I mean, nothing feels unnecessary,
right?
Which I guess is important. Yeah, you know,
there's Joseph Gordon-Levitt has like maybe one or two lines that are like you just feel like he's just trying to get out there like quickly, you know, and it feels like, kind of uncomfortable.
Of course,
I mean, I can't wait to see it again to see if I actually believe that, but right. I mean, because this thing is just like a whirlwind when you're watching it. It's like okay, because they're always jumping to a new rule or at least in the beginning, and then at the end it's a new.
And I mean, as for rules, I think some of the rules conflict.
Yes,
I think that it's not a perfect system. You know, I think, and like I mean, they almost make jokes about the fact that it's not a perfect system because there's actually a line in the movie where Joseph Gordon-Levitt says to Ellen Page, you know, because Leonardo DiCaprio is essentially the leader of the pack and the extractor, and he has all these rules after all these years of stealing dreams, or stealing ideas within dreams, and he, and Arthur, Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character, at one point says to Ellen Page, he says, so you've noticed how many times, you know, Cobb, who's Leonardo DiCaprio, breaks his own rules, right? And so it's kind of funny because it almost is an annoyance because it's like they set up all these rules and then they don't follow any of them. And like that's how things go crazy. But it's kind of one of these things where you're like, okay, well then why even, you know, like why would, you know, this Cobb character even set everything up? But then it comes to the surface why he's doing what he's doing and what his intentions are, and it all fits within the narrative of it. But at the same time, you know, the conflicting rules and stuff definitely leave for a lot of conversation, a lot of discussion, yeah. You know, and also a lot of criticism, you know. So, I mean, this film is not a film that's going to get 100% Rotten Tomatoes.
And it already hasn't, right.
And that is, you know, and that is, I think more to its, you know, to its aid than yeah. to its not aid, because it's a movie that is risky enough to not warrant a 100% Rotten Tomatoes. Yeah. And I think that's important for Nolan, you know what I mean?
Do you want to talk? We can also address like another couple criticisms that if you want to. Like yeah. one couple reviewers said that the last act is very bloated, which I never felt that.
I guess bloated in the sense of all the things that are going on at the same time, but I mean I didn't feel. It just feels very necessary.
We can talk about Shutter Island, how it kind of. That's one movie where I love the first two thirds, and then the third act is kind of bloated. And
well, like, I mean, Shutter Island. So I mean, yeah, I think a big difference between the two films, and which oddly have, you know, some very poignant similarities, which is kind of funny. But I think what Shutter Island suffers from is, you know, you have this story that has two layers. And I think Scorsese and Leto Caligridis, the writer, they decided to focus on one without disregarding the other. And so at the end, to essentially have one of these layers catch up, they have to literally have a character explain what's going on for 4 minutes. And it takes you out of the movie, like completely. Like, literally, it's as if one of the characters is looking, breaking the fourth wall, looking at you and saying, like, okay, just in case you guys didn't know what was going on, like, this is exactly what's happening. I'm going to write it on a board for you guys.
Yeah.
So you know. And, like, this is the rules that, like, maybe you didn't even know were going on because we never explained it. But these are, like, the you know, the numerology rules that are going on this entire time, just in case, and all this stuff. And, like, it's really, you know, off-putting. And then, luckily, it kind of picks back up and you have this kind of five-minute pimple. In this, you know, otherwise great film. This movie doesn't have that.
Everything is so intertwined.
Right, and I think that's important. Yeah. And so, is it bloated? I don't know. I mean, I guess it's an hour-long ending. but, like, was the 45-minute ending of The Dark Knight bloated? I never thought so. Like, I really had kind of the same exact reaction in terms of that ending, you know, as when I saw The Dark Knight, because The Dark Knight, it was one of these things where, like, I realized halfway through watching the climax that it was the climax, and I was like, oh my gosh, when this ends, the movie's gonna end. And in Inception, it's the same way. You're like, wow, once this mission is completed or not completed,
yeah.
You know, there's not gonna be much more movie. And it's almost sad.
I was just gonna say that. I felt sad.
Because just like with The Dark Knight, it's almost sad. It's like, damn it, like, another mission. Like, I want, you know, I want 2 more hours, you know.
Just there's, like, an exact moment where they go to a place and you kind of know it's the last thing they're gonna do, and we'll, and, like, as soon as that moment hit, as soon as they got to that place, I was like, oh, shit.
It's almost over.
This movie is gonna actually end.
I know, it's like, sad. It really is. I mean, and that is, you know, I was talking to a couple people last night, and they were saying how, you know, long movies, if a long movie can achieve that, it must have done something right. Because even movies that I love, like, I love King Kong, the Peter Jackson remake. I know a lot of people don't, but I really do love that movie. But even that movie, for me, 3 hours long, even that movie at the end, you know, I was like, okay, like, let's get there. Like, let's get there.
I'm ready.
Let's
I'm
get there, ready. Pete. Like, let's get to that. And then, obviously, Return of the King, that's a running joke, like, you know, 30 minutes too long, whatever. Like, Peter Jackson, incredible director, probably just as good as Nolan. They're probably in that same upper echelon of, you know, Spielbergian, you know, greatness, whatever. But, you know, most of Jackson's movies, even The Lovely Bones, which is like 90 minutes long, like, they go on a little bit too long for one reason or another. But for some reason, Nolan has this really beautiful way of pacing films, you know, and I, you know, I think it works. And I think you have to thank people like Wally Pfister. I think you have to thank people, you know, all, you know, everybody involved. You know, and it's just mind-blowing. That I really, you know, after 2 hours, I was sad that there was only, you know, 30 minutes left.
Yeah,
and so,
definitely.
And, you know, I wonder if audiences will feel the same way.
Yeah, I'm really excited to see how it does.
Curious.
But,
yeah.
Okay, so, spoiler.
Yeah,
we'll wrap it up. Yeah, we'll, I mean, absolutely everyone
yeah,
in the world,
go
see this movie.
Go see it.
I'm going to go see it again Thursday midnight.
Yeah,
I'm going to
go see it on Saturday. Yeah, I think, like, and look, it's whatever. I mean, for those who think it's weird, I mean, don't think it's weird. Yeah. I mean, this is like a entertaining film that at the very least it'll, I mean, even if you don't understand it, and that just means you're not paying attention, but even if you don't pay attention, you will love just so many superficial things about this movie, you know.
Like, well, I mean, even, you know, like, we had 11 people go to the screening last night. 10 people were blown away and loved it, and then my mom didn't really like it, but she said she still was wide awake the whole movie and really and kind
like
of
really into
invested.
It. Right,
so,
exactly. Yeah.
So I mean, it's still, even if you don't really
right, like, your dad, who's a lot older, loved it though. You know what I mean? So it's like I feel like, you know, our entire previous screening gasped at the end. You know, we'll talk about that later, but like gasped at the last shot of the film.
And for that, you need to be invested the whole time.
Amazing.
Kind of.
Right, and I mean, the last shot hinges on the fact that you understand what's going on, because there's an object that is important throughout the film, and if you don't know what that object means to the narrative, then you wouldn't be tense at all. And everybody in the theater gasped, the movie ended, and everybody clapped.
Yeah.
And I've been to just a shitload of
press screenings
and, you know, clapping for Harry Potter is one thing, but clapping for a completely original idea, you know, with really no exact idea of what you're gonna go into before seeing the film, and then seeing it, and then clapping at the end, they did something right.
Yeah.
And so I think that was a good sign. You know. So,
absolutely.
But yeah, okay. So we'll go into spoilers. Right. So if you haven't seen it, turn it off.
Turn off. I'll give you 5 seconds.
Yeah.
Just pause if you're on your car and keep turning it off, because you literally do not. Oh, by the way, if you have seen, I'll give this moment to turn it off so you can stop. But if you have not seen trailers or TV spots, just, if you've made it this far, stay away.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, but even if you do,
it's fine.
It won't ruin anything.
So. All right. So by now, you turn it off.
Yep. So
all right, that's good. Well, do you want to start? Okay, the opening scene. I love the way they handled it, because they show these little elements that, like, come back later. Like, the opening scene, I mean, those are listening, I've seen it, and there's, you know, it's kind of like a heist in Sato's.
Right, Sato's mine, and they're trying to steal an idea of his.
Yeah, and there's, like, little moments, like, they realize that he has kind of figured out that he's in the heist.
Right.
And, like, they're walking outside. It's, like, this beautiful, like, Japanese guard. Like,
one of the reasons this whole scene works is because you don't really know what's going on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you just see, like, a shingle fall off the house, and you're like, oh, shit, like, what's going on?
Yeah.
And then it introduces a character that plays a huge part. And actually, Marion Cotillard, I loved her in this opening scene more than I love, like, throughout. Even
actually one of the negative reviews I read of this film, David Edelstein for New York Magazine. I think actually the only one right now. One of the only negative reviews so far. Is there two?
Yeah.
He did say that, and it's funny because I totally do agree with you and him, that her opening is great. Like, it's a great opening scene where she's like on a balcony, and you don't really know who she is at this point, and Leo DiCaprio starts talking to her, and like Joseph Gordon-Levitt's like, you gotta handle it. Like, and you're like, what is, like, what, handle what? And she just looks like, just and then, like, if God created, she's Eve, you know, yeah. She's Helen of Troy. It's like, you know, and so you're just enthralled by her beauty, and then
the whole Joseph Gordon-Levitt thing, she shoots him, and then Leo just shoots him in the head. You're just like, it's just like, if you're not into the movie by then, I don't know what will get you into it.
Right, exactly.
And, if we want to keep going, I think the, there's little moments with Ellen Page that are great, like the setup. There's a scene that I think we talked about, the mirrors.
That
was great,
very beautiful,
and just the whole idea of creating these worlds, and then there's a scene, you know, when they're walking around, which isn't really shown in the trailers, but the city folds over, and then they're walking around the city, and like people, yeah, just the whole way.
I have a question though. Now that we're in spoilers,
yes.
And I was talking to my friend Kristen about this last night. Okay, so she's the architect. Ellen Page is the architect, right? And she, Lucas Haas is the architect in the beginning, but he fucks up.
With the carpet.
Yeah, with a lot of things. And they, and he essentially gets fired, and he gets kidnapped, essentially, actually, which is kind of crazy. And then Ellen Page is hired through Michael Caine, who is Maul's
professor.
Father. Who Maul is Marion Cotillard, who is Leo's ex-wife, or dead wife. Definitely. And, anyway, so Leo goes to Michael Caine. Michael Caine snatches Ellen Page, who's one of his best architecture students, and Leo, who plays Dom Cobb, hires her to be his architect, you know, of the mind, in so many words. And so what I was confused about is this. Okay, so she designs the architecture of the dream.
Yes.
And then they go in to the dream through her mind.
Through her mind, yeah.
Okay, so that's the first level. But then how does she design the architecture for the second level when they went through Tom Hardy's mind? Or, you know,
she designs all the levels.
Yeah, but how, though? Like, because she designs them so they're in her mind. Like, she designs them, right, on the table, and then so they're in her mind, and so that's how the architecture's there, because they're in her mind.
Right.
But then so how, if it goes through, for example, Robert Fisher, Killian Murphy's mind, how is it still her architecture? Because it's in his mind. That's what I didn't understand.
The first level, what is the first, the Los Angeles?
The first level is a hospital.
Right. Los Angeles train sequence, right? Isn't that the...
Yeah, but I mean, like, that's what she says. She's like, we'll go to a hospital. But, like, they don't get to the hospital. But, yeah. It's like in LA, yeah.
And then the second level is the
hotel.
The hotel, right. And she... That's still in her.
Well, yeah, because then when they go to the ski lounge,
she can hold that back.
She's entrance. Like, there must have been another way, maze and stuff. Yeah, and so yes, I can accept that. I can accept that. But what I can't, if someone has to explain to me. I would love to have someone to explain to me how, because they're going into other people's minds for each level.
Mm-hmm.
How does it remain her architecture? That's what I don't understand. Because then when they go into Leo's mind...
It's always her character, but it's their subconscious, right? But that's how...
Yeah, but then if you remember, though, then... But see, this is where it gets confusing, because then when they go into the fourth level to get Maul and Robert Fisher,
it's Leo's mind and his architecture.
So how does that make any sense? Because she didn't plan a fourth one? Is that why?
Well, I think they diverted from that, and they went into it. Because I think the way the dream machine works, like, you can set... Like, you set, like, who's going to be who. You know what I mean? Like, who... I mean,
I would have liked a 2-minute scene where Leo explained, or Cobb explained to Ariadne, who's Ellen Page, that, how the dream device works.
Mm-hmm.
Just so that, like, there's some sort of physical representation of, like, because you always see them push this, like, button in the middle sends people into sleep, but like I never see, like, and that was one of the things that leaves me confused thinking about it again. Obviously I'll see it again and I'll try to figure it out, but like, how does the architect continue to control all the different levels of the dream, you know, throughout, because it's not her mind that they're going into these different levels? Is it because it's initially her mind, but like that, I don't know if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I mean, I'm excited to see it.
I mean, it's so stuff like that, and then but then, you know, then they go into limbo.
Right. That's a great concept, I think.
Yeah, and because Leo and because Cobb and Maul, they went into limbo for like 50 years together. They created this whole world, and they go into his limbo, and which is also her limbo, and that's how they get Robert Fisher. And I accept all of that. But why is it not her architecture? Why is it not Ariadne's architecture? Because she was the one who they're technically, whose mind they're still in. It's just stuff like that. That's what I, you know. So, I mean, hopefully a second viewing will clear that up for me. I don't know.
But. Yeah, but no, yeah, no, totally.
We can and then you said, and then what you and you, one of your things was, you know, you said they never actually showed them getting out of the first level of dreams at the end.
Yeah, so like this is the way. I mean, for those who've seen the setup, the way they handle it is like there's 30 seconds in the in the first layer.
Is, well, I mean, there's as much time as there is, right? But it's just like the different.
Like, oh no, I was just explaining like what yeah. I loved about like and then there's 3 minutes in the hotel level right. And then an hour in the ski and then years I guess, which they I don't know if
that's the thing.
Sado, someone said Sado was in limbo, but I thought Sado at the end is in the years, like he's in like the blast level, which is many years, you know.
Well, isn't that limbo?
I thought limbo was if you die, like if you're sedated and you die, you just go.
Yeah, but like, but Robert Fisher dies, and he is in the same place that Saito and.
Oh right, okay, yeah, they're not, yeah.
So I'm pretty sure that I'm. What I assumed was that limbo and the fourth level of dreaming were the same thing.
Okay, that makes a lot more sense.
Just because it would, because there's no other way to explain how like Fisher dies, so he goes into one more level of dreaming. That's the way. That, yeah, you know, that's what they said, and then like, and that's why Ellen Page is like, you know. But see, that's another thing. I wish that there would just been one line where they're like, you know, the fourth level is the same as limbo. And you're like, okay,
yeah,
like that sounds good. And then so then like when they have to do that, when you know when Leo and Ellen Page have to literally go down one more level through Leo's mind into this whole city that he's created to save Robert Fisher, I, you know, because like I just assumed. But then like, why isn't Leo so much older when he finds Satu though?
Because I think because he gets pulled out of his. He like he's in one more level than what Sato's in. So like if he's old, you know, if he was old in his limbo or something, and he got pulled out again, and mm-hmm. then he becomes young in that level that Sato's also in. But I mean,
see, that's the thing.
I can't. And I'm excited to see it again. Yeah.
So that's just so like this is the nitpicky stuff that a second viewing will obviously hopefully be helpful on. But yeah. But like okay, so like what? Yeah. So okay, so one thing that I loved was the whole no gravity thing.
Yes, yeah, the way they, I mean, we know, I mean, if you've seen the clips and read some interviews, you know that Joseph Gordon-Levitt did his own stunts and they actually formed this thing, but then in that actual fight, it goes to another level where they enter like a bedroom and they're fighting in that, which is awesome because that's not shown in any, you know, any of the trailers. Right. And then,
but like,
and
it goes from a then, tilting room, you know, where you see him running on the walls, which is amazing, and I can accept that they could shoot that somehow with the, because they actually made a tilting trailer.
Yes, yeah.
But then it goes to literally a no gravity.
Yeah, they give him the kick. The kick starts, and so he has 3 minutes in the kick in you know the free fall mm-hmm. to transport and give his whole mission is to give these.
But because in the first level of dreaming they're falling. There's no gravity.
Right. Yeah, in the first level of dreaming, Yusef or what? Yusef in the movie. Yeah. The van is like. Which is crazy. He's getting chased by all these motorcyclists and like
projections who are literally like designed to
security
secure Robert Fisher's mind are chasing are Yusef and who and everybody.
And so somehow the van flips over and then also
flips over and then like
but they're fine.
Yeah, and that's the tilting scene. And then they're driving on a bridge and then he like backs up. Really not a good driver. He backs through a bridge. All you know through the railing of a bridge off that bridge.
Yeah.
And so in that like. You know, however long that would take, whatever, three seconds, you know, he's falling.
And that makes up an hour of the movie.
And that makes up, and that essentially makes up, like an hour of the film. And so during that time in Joseph Gordon-Levitt's, because here's another thing that I don't understand, and you have to explain this to me.
Hit me.
Maybe. How does Joe Gordon-Levitt have no gravity and the people in the third level do?
Riddle what do you that. Mean? In the next well they're it's like different ways of like in the third level that when the kick happened it was the storm, you know, like I think it's different, there's different manifestations of the kick, you know what I mean, so maybe they plan it so that
yeah, but like my point is the reason that he had no gravity is because they were falling off into the ocean
mm-hmm.
or into the river right. So that means there's no gravity. So how would that not transfer through to the third level where they would have no gravity? That's what I was confused about.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
You know what I mean? Is that? But like, I guess because each level is separate. But you know what I mean? Yeah. Like stuff like that is like gets a little confusing. You know, and then but either way. So I just love the way that they shot the no gravity stuff. I guess it could have been as simple as harnesses that were taken out, I guess. I mean, that's really easy.
But it feels so, like, that they're actually in gravity. You know what I mean? Like, with harnesses, they, I feel like it would have to take a lot of, like, there literally would have to be a puppeteer up top that's kind of, like, gliding him. Like, because right. It feels so natural.
That's the thing. It really, like, was wild. Amazing. Man. Yeah, I mean, and so stuff like that, like, and even, like, stuff like him flying, you know, when, like, the car gets hit, he, like, literally flies from one side of the hotel hallway to the other, and, like, the way that they shoot it, and I guess they must have just messed with the camera angle, because he's, like, falling down, but he's falling forward.
Yeah.
And it's so crazy. Like, I don't know
That entire scene, my mouth is just down. I said, holy shit, like, at least 10 times under my breath.
I was just like, I think I laughed in enjoyment, like, 48 times during the film. Like, I was just like, wow, like, what the fuck? Like, so, you know, stuff like that, I can't wait for, like, a Blu-ray to study. See the behind the scenes, you know, or whatever, you know, fucking see. Yeah, to study too, but.
Yeah, and then, like, there's scenes, some of my favorite shots were the slow motion scenes in the 30 second fall, like the van sequence. Like, there's a scene where it's because it's raining there. Oh, which was kind of fun. Did you like that? The Yusef, he peed in the plane, so it was raining. In the next dream, did you get that?
No.
He pissed in the plane. He's like, when they first got into the LA, they were like, you really had to go to the bathroom? And, like, and that's why it was raining. And then they're like, oh, Cillian Murphy would never get a cab in the rain. Like, it would be impossible to get a cab, and they're really worried. So that's why it was raining the whole time.
What?
Yeah.
That's why it's raining? Yeah. Because Yufus is pissing?
Well, he peed, like, I guess, yeah, he, like, peed, like, in the... on the plane, and I guess that translated over.
What?
Yeah.
I have to watch this movie again. Yeah. Damn. All right.
But anyway, so, like...
That's funny.
So it brings these shots that, like, you kind of see glimpses on the trailer, but, like, in context, they're so cool. Like, their shots, which you didn't see in the trailer, but the van literally skidding, like, as it's raining out of, like, onto, like, the street, and then as it cuts back to Joseph Gordon-Levitt, you know, fighting, and then, like, there's shots of... there's the van flipping over, which is just so well done. I don't even know, like, it just looked just, oh, it's outstanding. And the third level of dreaming, the winter scene, I really like the way they did that with the skiing and stuff.
That was probably one of my least favorite, like, set pieces, just
well,
because...
it's hard to live up to the hallway fight, kind of, and also hard to live up to the slow
motion. Well, just because it's hard, because it's, like, it's all white, and it's skiing. You know, I've always felt like skiing scenes are always better in concept than they are in reality. Mm. Like, you know, because, like, for example, James Bond, that's probably the closest it comes to a James Bond movie, because, I mean, James Bond, I think every 5 movies in the contract, there's supposed to be a ski shootout. You know, like, literally, I think, like... of the 21 Bond films, there's, like, you know, probably 7 films that have, like, a random ski shootout. So, you know what I mean? And, like, and they're fun, but it's just kind of silly because, like, you know, you're skiing down a hill, and I guess it's kind of cool. But it's just, my point is, it never lives up to the hype. Because, like, when I watched the trailer for this, I was like, wow, that ski scene's going to be sick. And it was sick, but, like, I liked the hallway scene a lot more, and I liked pretty much everything else a lot more. But I liked the way they handled it. And, like, I mean, this movie, though, you know, for all of the, you know, you said how it tries to keep things kind of realistic in terms of, like, costume design and stuff.
Yeah.
It is, like, so ridiculous. Like, it is so ridiculous. There's, like, a scene where Saito's shot and he's, like, slowly dying in the dream and in real life, you know, kind of a thing. And it's him and Tom Hardy, and they're literally holding off, like, a platoon of people trying to kill them because, like, they're the projections that Robert Fisher got, like, implanted in his head to protect people like them. And it's just, like, ridiculous. Like, Tom Hardy literally kills, like, 14 people, and Saito's dying, and he's, like, shooting these people. Like, it makes no sense how they don't
The bad guys in this film have very horrible aim.
They're the henchmen of henchmen. Like, they are, like, so... They're, like, the putty men from Power Rangers. Like, they are horrible.
Yeah.
They miss, like, they kill... They don't kill anybody.
Yeah.
Like, at the end, everybody's, you know, spoilers. At the end, like, everybody lives.
Yeah. Oh, one awesome part, too.
It's so funny.
Which we can go back to. The shoot, the LA scene. I really thought, like, I got some Heat vibes there. That shootout. In the street.
Oh, in the.
Yeah. I really like that because
that was a nice little heat shout out. Yeah,
I totally agree.
I thought the rain. I mean, pissing or not aside, like, I thought the rain was brilliant. Oh, like, yeah. I love that production design. Yeah. You know?
And there's even for a PG-13 movie, there's these little shots that some guy gets slammed up against a car, and then the car peels away, and he kind of flips over, and then there's another shot where the motorcycle gets hit off, and he's falls off his motorcycle, and just wild shots that so yeah. believable and just like
make, you know what's funny about the movie though what's funny about the movie, and I was thinking about this, is I remember when I saw The Dark Knight, I was like, wow, I can't believe that was PG-13 because tonally it's just so dark and there's these scenes that are, but this movie's in a strange way I kind of felt like it was almost like a family entertainment and it's not, because there's a whole lot of stuff about suicide and many people die many times because you're in a dream world, so
there's no Joker in this. I mean, that Joker was truly
exactly it's fun and I'm taking my 12-year-old brother to see it, and I'm not worried at all that he'll be disturbed.
Yeah. And even the scenes with the children and Harvey Dent's children almost dying, in this movie, they're such a more positive. I even talked about this with Shutter Island, in the end, the children die.
Yeah, he's trying to get back to his children.
In this movie, he's trying to get back, and the end, we can talk about it, the end is so
I love the idea, the whole thing is, because in his memories, he has this very specific memory where he has to run, he has to flee the country or get arrested for this crime that his wife, who killed herself, set him up for.
Yeah.
He has to flee the country, and so in this moment where he has to go, kind of a now or never moment, he, calls out for his children, but, he gets interrupted, and then he turns back to, call out for his children again, but they've run away, and so in these dreams that he creates through memories, which is apparently a very dangerous thing, he can't see his children's faces because in real life he didn't see his faces.
Yeah,
so the entire movie you don't see their faces. Yeah. So it's kind of this weird, almost anti-Shining thing.
Yeah.
Where it's
there were moments like that where it did feel a little Kubrick touch. Especially there's a scene with...
That's the thing. There are Kubrick things in it. Obviously the two kids that he sees shining. But, it's in such a different way.
Oh, yeah.
Because these kids don't, get spliced, chopped up, and then whole again. It's completely different. There's this... The sadism that is Kubrick, the psychoanalytical sadism that, inspired half of that guy's fucking movies, is not in any of Nolan's films. The closest one being The Dark Knight, but, Nolan is a much more populist filmmaker.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, what were you saying?
There's a scene where he's in Marion Cotillard, or he's in his dream in Marion Cotillard, once, or he's in her limbo, I guess, or he...
And
he goes to turn to his children, and she's like, come on, just watch him. And then he turns away, he's like, those aren't my children. Would they have been just projections of someone else, you think? I was wondering what...
Well, I think the idea is he can't see them or else he'll stay.
Oh, okay.
I think that's kind of what it was, you know what I mean? Because, if he's able to see their faces, he'd probably end up, believing that, her world was real. But, I think the question that is brought up in full form at the end of the film, which ends on a cliffhanger, is her world the real world?
Yeah.
Because at the end of the film, obviously, there's these things called totems that every single person who's dreaming has to have so that they know it's real, because it's this individual thing that they make. And if they're holding it, and they know that they're in the real world, not the dream world, because there's no way that you could project it or something like that. And
Ellen Page kind of made a stupid totem, like a chess piece, it would just have fallen over.
But it was a weighted one, though.
So what, it just kind of tipped
over?
Yeah,
because you know how Arthur had a weighted die.
Yeah,
that's what he said.
I was just wondering.
I think the idea that
of course
Leo
had the coolest
weighted
one.
So that you would go, of course, you would roll I guess Gordon Levitt's die is if you roll it would always hit a six.
It's
weighted.
Yeah.
And so that's how he would know. But Leo's is, I don't even know what you call it. It's a top. Yeah, spinning top. So he knows that he's not in a dream world.
I'm going to get a dreidel.
If it topples over and stops spinning. That's how you know that you're in the real world.
And so
in
the
dream world, it doesn't stop spinning.
Right.
And so at the end, they succeed in the mission. Saitu comes through on his promise and somehow gets all of his charges dropped with one phone.
Oh yeah, I was just gonna
say, which is so ridiculous. But anyway, so he comes home and there's this really nice moment, I guess, where he gives his passport to the immigration guy, and the guy looks at him and says welcome home, Mr. Cobb. It's oh, that's nice, because he's trying to do the whole, and he gets in, and then he gets in and all the main characters start looking at him in this way that would suggest that maybe he's still dreaming, because when someone realizes they're dreaming, all the projections look at them.
Yeah.
And so everybody starts looking at him kind of, times, and you're like, oh, this is weird. Like, why is everybody looking at him like it's a dream? And then he goes home, and Michael Caine's, like, there, miraculously from London, and it's like, how did he get there? Know. Like, how did he know? Yeah. You know, he's there with, like, cop sign, yeah. And it's, like, very happy, and like, oh, the kids, and he goes home, and like, oh, the kids are home, my dad's home, and it's, like, very happy. And then there's a top that's spinning on the table, and it does, like, a little thing, like, oh, it's gonna turn over, but then it doesn't, it keeps spinning, and then the movie stops. So it leaves you thinking, like, is this a dream, or is this real?
What's your take?
And I think it's to each his own, it's a choose-your-own ending. I'm sure many people will ask Christopher Nolan in the next 7 decades what he thinks the ending is, and I'm confident he'll never answer that question. But I think it probably was a dream, you know. I think it probably was a dream. That said, I am cynical by nature,
yeah.
Right? Like I think I'm much more cynical than Christopher Nolan, right? So I think in terms of endings, I think Nolan is closer to Spielberg than he is to a Kubrick or Scorsese. And which is to say, I think he's more of an optimist.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think that probably it's not a dream, and probably in some miraculous way it's a happy ending. But for myself, and I think this is why he ends it like this, for cynics and optimists alike, I think that I have to think to myself, it's a dream, either Maul was right, and that literally, you know, he was the one who was confused, and she was the one who was right, you know, kind of a thing. Or you know, literally, they were just still, the whole movie itself is a dream, and it's, the movie starts in the first level of that dream, and they really go to the fifth level,
mm-hmm.
Or something like that, and you know, there's still one more level to go up on, or something. Yeah. You know, so I think, you know, but obviously, I mean, what do you think? You think?
Yeah, I mean, everything you said before the spinning top, it makes it feel like a dream, and then the spinning top, like,
I mean, I think
it's so nicely 50-50 that it's...
Yeah, but I think an important thing, too, about the people looking is, the people who are looking at him, the majority of the people who are looking at him are the main players in the film,
mm-hmm.
So it could be as simple as, like, they're all amazed that he pulled it off.
Yeah.
You know, so it could be like, wow, like he actually got, like, Saito actually made a phone call, and, yeah. You know, Cobb is back on American soil.
Well, and if you see all their faces, all the people that were part of the heist, I mean, not Cillian Murphy, but all the other people kind of give him a little smile and, like, kind of happy.
Right, well,
and then Cillian Murphy is like kind of looks at him like, oh, you were that guy on the plane. You know what I mean? Like, not like, you know.
Exactly. True.
Like, he gives him, it's true. Not really a
smile. But then, like, I caught a couple other random characters looking at him.
Yeah, that's why I'm excited
and
to see.
And that's the and thing, that makes it because yeah. It's like, oh, wait. You know, like, that's, and then the Michael Caine thing, I laughed, actually, because I was like, why the fuck is he here? Like, why, how did he know? Like, how did Michael Caine know? But, dude, how brilliant was that setup, though? Like, the plane ride from wherever to L.A., and then, like, I turned to my friend Chris, and I said that to her, like, I was like... Because Cobb says to Saito, he's like, you know, if we land in L.A. and you don't come through on your promise, like, they arrest me when we land. And I was like, oh, my God, that's awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, like, they're on this plane, and they're doing this amazing mission on this 10-hour flight. And, like, if anything goes wrong, like, you know, either they'll die in limbo, you know, or live in limbo, or, like, he'll just get arrested.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And that would have been such a sick ending, too. Like, if after all that, Saito, like, just was lying. Yeah. And, like... You know, after all that, Cobb just got arrested.
Do you want to talk about one thing we haven't even talked about, the other plot line, the Cillian Murphy?
Why the whole movie's happening?
Yeah, and so it sets it up as like Cillian Murphy, his father's dying. He has his business.
He's the
Saito wants his business. He wants that to break apart and. Cillian Murphy to start
it's like,
his own.
It's a really interesting, and it's like a
break
really,
up monopoly.
It's a really interesting, yeah, but it's like an interesting, like, corporate, like I almost was laughing because it almost seemed like a dream thing. Like, Saito's this really rich businessman who wants to break up, I guess this is true, but he wants to break up the Fisher Corporation because he's the only person left standing in between, you know, Fisher and a complete monopoly over whatever corporation, like, whatever business they're doing. And so, in order to prevent that monopoly, he wants them to plant the idea in Fisher's head that he should break up the companies. And it just seems funny to me that, like, a businessman would care that much about, you know, a democracy that like he would have them break them one up. But
I mean, some of the best moments of the film are when like you start to realize like it goes away from the action spectacle and you start to realize that like Cillian Murphy, like they're actually convincing him. Like I love like parts where Tom Berenger, and he like, you know, he comes in and he like
and Tom Hardy into the like hotel to be,
yeah, and I love that part. But then what do you think, you know, of the kind of like the Citizen Kane, the ending?
Well, there's a Rosebud. Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, there's a what do you call that? You know,
the wind.
You know, like a windmill. Windmill, little paper thing that kids make. And like, there's this picture throughout of him with the windmill and his father holding him, and like, I guess that's like the one memory, kind of a thing, kind of like Citizen Kane's Rosebud that the young Fisher still holds on to. So in the safe at the end of the film, which is the safe they're trying literally to get Fisher to open to get the idea to split up the companies on his own, is the windmill, which I guess would imply that like he made the windmill and his father was proud of him for it.
Yeah, well, I mean,
that is his memory of his father not being disappointed in him.
Yeah, well, he said the whole thing is before he died in real life, he said, I'm disappointed. And then you don't know what that means. At the end, it goes, I'm disappointed. You tried to be like me, right?
Is that, yeah, well, said? Well, no. Fisher says, in the vault is a room very much like 2001, where the old man is in the white room. This is a black room.
That's actually true.
Yeah. And so Fisher goes in, and his father's there in this vault, and his father says, disappointed, and then Fisher says, I know you were disappointed that I couldn't be like you. And then Pete Postlethwaite, who plays the father, says, I'm disappointed that you tried. And you're like, whoa.
Yeah, and then it's sad because it's not really true
because it's a projection. You know what I mean? So like, you know, the dad probably fucking hated him in real life.
But it's nice of a first character that he like kind of breaks through that.
What's fascinating about the entire film.
Yeah,
because it kind of just explores the realness of dreams. You know, like Leo says, you know, dreams feel real when we're inside them. The viewer, you know, when Fisher kind of starts to cry because like his dad, surprisingly accepts him, you know, it's sad because you're like, wow, thank God that like his dad accepts him, but really his dad doesn't accept him. I mean, this is Fisher himself convincing himself that his dad accepts him, and so maybe it's a little bit more cynical than, you know, I was saying 10 minutes before, because you have this kind of, you know, this thing going on. But I mean, yeah, so, and it's stuff like that that makes you think, like, you know, and the, you know, the tagline, the dream is real, you know, I think he's dreaming at the end. But I mean, who knows? Definitely something to talk about for a long time.
Yeah, and one thing we didn't even talk about either is the score. I love
it. Oh, brilliant.
It's so intertwined in the movie.
You know, brilliant, and yeah, intertwined, yeah. And like not as like in your face as the Dark Knight score.
And like, yeah.
You know, like I don't remember it the way I remember the Dark Knight score, but I love that.
Yeah.
Because this is a movie that is like the score should just be a compliment to the brilliance that's happening around it, you know? And like, you know, not that the Dark Knight wasn't brilliant, but like, but this was something else, you know. There's a lot of different music, you know. I can't wait to listen to it on my ride home because, like, there's a lot of different songs. Like, you know, one of the favorite being the chase scene that wasn't even a dream in Mombasa.
Oh, Mombasa,
you know,
yeah, that's like, we didn't talk about that. That's a great
chase scene. That's not even a dream scene.
Yeah.
And that's one of the best tracks, you know, of the soundtrack.
This is a good point. A lot of Nolan critics say that he can't really shoot action. That's like one of his big things.
I think they're just wrong.
Yeah, and even in Dark Knight, I didn't mind it, so I don't think I'm the greatest person to ask. Yeah, people still have problems with Dark Knight.
I love the action in Dark Knight. One of my least. Okay, I'll say this quickly about Dark Knight. A scene I have always had a problem with, always, is that club scene where he like beats up Eric Roberts.
Yeah.
Cause like, what happened? Yeah. That is the darkest scene I've ever seen in a film. It's like annoying. That scene really pisses me off.
Well, someone says about the Dark Knight, we could talk about comparison to Inception. The scene in the underground subway while they're going, the prison transfer scene.
Mm-hmm.
There's no sense of like how long is this, like where the cars are in the subway.
True.
Like, kind of.
True.
And I mean, I had no problem with that scene.
My biggest problem with that scene is that is Nicky Cat as like the weird comic relief because it's like part of a different film.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, he's funny, but it doesn't belong.
Yeah, that's another thing about Inception. There's no moments like that. Like the comedy works.
Totally not.
Unlike a kind of superhero cliche movies where like there's the kid that sees the Batmobile, right. Like I mean stuff like that. Yeah, there's nothing like that.
Yeah.
And no, but I mean in terms of action in Inception, like I could that Mombasa Street. There's a lot of, you know, shaky close up, but it works with the thing.
Yeah, but it works. Yeah. Yeah, it totally works. Like this is the thing. I always find it funny that people jump down Nolan's throat for the way he shoots action, and they like praise Greengrass. I'll never fully understand that because, like, listen, I love Ultimatum as much as anyone else, but like, you know, that action is impossible to follow. It's impossible to follow. Yeah. You know, and like, I love it because it's kinetic and all that, but like, don't try to tell me that Greengrass knows how to shoot action better than Nolan. Like, those, you know, the shaky cam, that ridiculous fight in Supremacy where he fights literally someone who looks exactly like Matt Damon.
Yeah.
Someone will have to explain to me one day why that was ever a good idea. Like, at least Batman has horns.
Yeah.
So you can always tell who it is. Like, I mean, so stuff like that, I'll never understand. Like, and in this movie, I think definitely will silence critics.
In the hallway fight scene, it's just one scene that, like, there's very long extended shots of them fighting. Right. And then when they get in the bedroom, it's a lot more cut up, but it's still
There's definitely a lot of cuts, but I mean, you know, he's running on walls that are moving.
Yeah.
That is something, for God's sake.
And, I mean, the winter scene, everything, there's no action. I was really disappointed in that. Like you said, it doesn't live up to the hallway scene, but it's fine. Oh, I actually love one moment with Leo. It takes out a skier and then climbs on, then is carried by a snowmobile and climbs on the snowmobile, knocks the guy off.
Wasn't that Tom Hardy?
No, Leo, because he blows up.
That was
up.
Leo?
Yeah, because he blows up.
I thought that was Tom Hardy.
Because remember, he throws a grenade and Leo, like, gives him a thumbs up.
Yeah. Okay.
And, there's like, yeah, and that was great. And one other, it's not really action, but the whole, even the stuff with Ellen Page seems like kind of action because they're these big spectacles, but like, when she realizes how she gets out of dreams, and like when the wake me up part where Manon Cotillard enters his subconscious and then goes to stab her, and
he's like, "Real charmer you got there, Cobb." Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Is there any other points?
I don't know. I mean, you know, I think we've exercised our enjoyment of this film. You know,
yeah. The architecture, beautiful.
This whole movie.
I mean, Nolan is known. If you read any interviews, he loves obsessed with architecture. This is the one.
We went with an architect who absolutely loved it.
She said this movie is probably made for her.
Absolutely loved it. She was jealous of Ellen Page because she got the job.
Yeah.
Another
cool thing, Wally Pfister's cinematography in terms of a lot of the panning over city shots. You kind of feel like these cities that are actually in real life are very
mazes in architecture.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, I think, is there any spoilers?
I think we've talked about them. I think that's it.
That's it.
I think we're spent.
Yeah. I'm sure though
we have Incepted.
A lot to discuss on Inception, and I mean, as more people see it, and kind of.
I mean, I'm excited to track its full take. I think this will be a movie that, kind of like Avatar, you know, will gross, you know, a significant amount its first weekend, and not break any records or anything, but a significant amount. And then I think by word of mouth, by critical appraisal and what have you, it'll you know, have a 5% drop, and a 5% drop, and a 5% drop, and hopefully, you know, it'll make enough money to warrant another, you know, slew of artistic movies. Hopefully, hopefully Fox follows suit the way Warner Brothers did, and, you know, they get, people to make art projects, you know. I mean, it's happening, you know. Shutter Island was a success, that was an art project, you know, hopefully Inception will be a success, an art project, you know, hopefully Leo isn't the only actor who'll be able to do these movies at high budgets from now on, because I think that this is what the public is going to realize that they want.
Yeah, I mean,
as opposed to things like Prince of Persia and A-Team, I think they're going to want, you know, intelligent entertainment.
Yeah. If you're with this film 100% and you get to the end, like, there's no way I would, like, could not recommend it to anyone.
Yeah, I mean, even if I didn't like it, I would say it has to be seen.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, just like your mom, you know, it has to be seen even if you don't enjoy it. I mean, I think it's such an original experience. I mean, why wouldn't you see it? I mean, it's the reason movies were made.
Yeah.
You know, to take you somewhere else. So.
Yeah. I mean, right now the weekend estimate is 40 to 50 million.
So right, which is disappointing. But so hopefully that, you know, hopefully with things like this, like this podcast.
I mean, Avatar made 78. Right. I mean, and that, you know, highest grosser, so we'll see.
Yeah.
I mean, the funny thing is that actually Avatar will stop. It's because Avatar is getting re-released on August 27th. And because Inception, you know, starts in IMAX July 16th, this Friday, and then it was going to be the only one in IMAX until September 10th with Resident Evil Afterlife, and so that was almost two solid months. But now Avatar's coming back August 27th, so I wonder if like it'll knock it out of IMAX theaters. Like, I don't know. Yeah. by that time, now that's a month and a half, so we'll see. Hopefully,
I mean, we'll know by then. I think
how well it does.
Yeah.
But grab all your friends.
Yeah.
Anyone you can, go see the movie, and then you'll immediately want to see it again. I mean,
it's something to be experienced, for sure.
Yeah, and then in terms of, you know, we want to get an Oscar thing, because a lot of people are talking about Oscars.
Yeah.
I mean, I think...
I think definitely Best Picture.
Do you think this could be Christopher Nolan's Best Director?
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be stupid if, you know, it didn't get, you know, Best Picture, Best Director, you know, cinematography. I'm talking nominations. Best Director, Best Picture, Best Cinematography, Best Screenplay, Best Original Screenplay, obviously. Oh, yeah. I mean, it has to.
Yeah.
And I mean, as for acting, I think that's really maybe where it might not. I don't really know. And then, you know, effects, sound. I mean, I think this is a movie that might get 10 noms without getting an acting nom.
Which, yeah, I mean, it could be very much like Avatar, no acting noms.
Very much like Slumdog.
Slumdog, yeah.
You know, so yeah. But, I mean, I think it's one of those movies, you know. And with 10 nominations, goddamn, it's got to get one.
Yeah.
The Blind Side could get nominated. I mean, shit.
Shit.
So, yeah, but go see it.
Absolutely go see it, man. Thank you for listening to the Film Stage Pod.
Yes, thank you very much.
We've been on and off this week, I know, because we've been
Busy, a lot of things, summertime.
Do you want to quick mention, Last Airbender is one of the most atrocious films I've
ever
seen.
Yeah, don't ever see it. It's horrible. I walked out of it. Only the second movie I've walked out of in the last 5 years, and I've walked out of two movies this year. And so that's 2 and 5.
Yep.
Both in one.
Yep. And so, then Predators we saw, decent.
You know, state of the ending. The ending's good.
Yeah, I mean, but in
Feel Free to Sleep while Larry Fishburne is performing, because it is one of his most worst performances.
Yeah, and I would
miscast in every single one.
I mean, now that Inception will be out by the time you're listening to this, I'd rather see Inception twice than Predators once.
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, Predators is the perfect example of a Robert Rodriguez produced film. It's on the cheap, it's kind of fun, and it's overrated.
Yeah, and Despicable Me, I saw. Don't know what all the hype is about. It's a average family film.
Yeah, I haven't seen it. I don't really have an attention to it.
But no, Inception all the way, baby.
Yeah, that's all I can say. Hopefully it'll live up to its own hype. So.
Yeah. But. And yeah, next week, what's it called? Oh, Salt.
Whatever. Salt, whatever. I don't know. It's tracking well, so. Yeah. You know, Angelina Jolie, one of the last movie stars. Yeah.
The guy from Boston Herald, he said it is the best damn action thriller I've seen in years.
Best damn action thriller. Philip Noyce knows how to make an action thriller. Yeah. Patriot Games, Clear and Present Danger.
Yeah.
You know, The Saint. I was just kidding about that last one. But he knows how to make an action thriller, so hopefully this is his return to form, if you will.
Yes, yes. So, yeah, we'll be back in the future.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully we'll be back soon. Yeah, so so stay tuned.
Yeah, and if you want to discuss Inception in our comments, you can comment on any points, questions we've had. If you know the answer, definitely comment.
Yeah.
Just tweet us. You'd know it by now. So. Yeah,
and now we have talked about the film for about half of its running time, and we were nowhere near as entertaining as the film could ever be in 10 minutes. So thank you for listening and sticking with us.
Yes. Goodbye, everyone.